free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see our past lineup of speakers, download some past shows, see what's coming down the pike, and you'll see that today, July 21st, 2008, we have Tom Roach, who's a project director over at Checkmate C Energy. They have licensed the Anaconda technology, which is they also call it the Bulge Wave technology. It's basically a tube that floats on the ocean or the sea to harness the up and down motion of the waves. We'll be talking about how that works and where they're at in process of rolling this out. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Well, good evening.
Good evening there. It's good afternoon here. You're over in the UK.
I am, yes.
Yeah. Well, tell us about this technology. It looks like the image you have on your site looks like a big, long fish tied to a pole.
Yeah, that's right. A typical Anaconda machine, the actual bulge tube, which is the part which captures the energy from the sea, might be 200 meters long and perhaps 7 meters in diameter when it's pre-inflated. It works by the excitation of bulge waves in the elastic walls of the tube. So it's made mainly of elastic rubber, and the inventors, Professors Rod Rainey and Francis Farley, discovered that if you can get the natural speed of propagation of the bulge wave to move at the same speed as the propagation of the sea wave which is passing it, then a bulge wave will be excited in the tube, which will gather energy from the sea wave as the sea wave passes along it. In other words, you get resonance.
Now, one thing that I don't quite have my head wrapped around yet with your system is I understand how a wave of the ocean could help propagate a bulge within the tube as it goes along, kind of like a surfer catching a wave, but I'm not understanding how you're capturing that to harness for energy. Are you actually having a moving fluid that's going through a turbine? How's that working?
Yeah, the easiest way to think about it is like this. If you feel your pulse in your wrist, you're actually feeling a bulge wave, and that is a wave which has passed down the elastic walls of the artery from your heart, and it's how your heart transmits energy to the place where it is needed to push the blood through the small vessels and muscles and so on without having to have excessively high blood pressure. Now, if you imagine an elastic tube full of water just under the surface of the ocean, it's a closed tube. So when the tube is lifted, this is the simplest way of looking at it, then obviously the water will lifted by a wave. The water inside the tube will want to run down towards the trough of the wave. But it can't because there's nowhere for it to go because the tube is closed. So it creates a bulge in the tube. So the energy is actually stored in the elasticity of the rubber by the tube being continuously lifted by the wave as it passes along its length. When it gets to the end, this can create a surge of water from the end, which then has to be rectified in a power takeoff system, and can pass through a turbine, and then can be drawn back into the tube during the negative pressure phase.
Okay. Now, one of the things that, as I was thinking about this last week, I've had a number of people bringing this story to our attention. There was published in the news about your system. A number of agencies picked it up, Green Car Congress, Mendo Coast Current,
yep,
the other places, and I was at the same time reading a book about Nikola Tesla, And one of the last things he invented was called a valvular conduit, basically a series of, it was a way that fluid would go one way but not really the other. And it wasn't a valve system like you have in arteries and veins where the blood will go one way but not go back the other way. It's actually kind of a, hard to describe it without actually seeing the picture. I posted a page on our website about it. We're going to be putting that in our news here any day now. In conjunction with this, we created a feature page about your company. But the idea of his system was to be able to create a vacuum because the air would go one direction but not the other, and so you could evacuate a tube, and you know, that was one application of this. But as I was thinking about that and thinking about yours, it occurred to me that those two systems could be combined. So you put Tesla's valvular conduit inside of these tubes that are going up and down in the water, and what would basically happen is the up and down movement would serve to jostle the fluid, and the jostling would make it go one way because of Tesla's design. And so whether the wave was going up or down, just the sheer movement would be causing the fluid to go in one direction, and you would then tie that to a turbine and run a turbine with the harnessing the energy from the up and down motion of the waves.
Yes, I understand what you're getting at, and you know, as you know, you've already brought the idea to our attention. Let me say at the outset that one of the things that we do need for this system to make it work well is very efficient, low-loss valves. But the actual system itself works by storing energy in the form of the bulge wave, which is actually energy stored in the elasticity of the tube. And you can work out how much energy is stored by how much elastic rubber you need in the walls of the tube. With what you're really describing with your Tesla valve idea is really no different from just having a non-distensible hose pipe, like a sort of thing that farmen would use, laying on the ground with water in it and just lifting it up progressively and pushing the water along to one end. Now, people have thought of wave energy machines that do this before, but because they're not, because the there is no resonance between the natural speed of the wave inside the tube and the and that of the passing sea wave, you don't actually capture any additional energy, and all wave energy machines must have some degree of resonance in order to function cost effectively. Otherwise, they would just be too big and heavy. So it doesn't matter what type of machine it is, if it's a buoy or a flapping plate type machine, the natural frequency of the machine has to be the same as the passing sea waves, the resonance, in order to make it capture energy from an area wider than the actual device itself.
Now, one of the things on our brief little description we have for you, you're saying that you could produce a 1 megawatt generator at around 12 cents per kilowatt hour, which is about twice as much as what you might pay for coal-fired power, but is comparable to other leading wave energy systems. Maybe you can talk about the what size of unit would be producing 1 megawatt. That's quite a bit.
Yeah, sure. The sort of size we envisage, if it were to be, say, 200 meters long and 7 meters in diameter, weighing about 200 tons, which is very light for a wave energy machine, it would actually gather about 1.6 megawatts from the sea. After conversion, that's the maximum figure, after conversion losses and so on, the rated output, in other words, the maximum electrical output, would be about 1 megawatt. And then taking into account the variation in wave conditions in a typical year, certainly off the west coast of Scotland in the UK, you'd end up with an annual average output of about 600 kilowatts, which is a very high figure for a machine of that weight. And obviously in the wave energy business, power to weight ratio is almost everything because it's directly related to cost effectiveness.
Is this thing going to be hard to mark? Because it basically rides right on the surface of the water, and you've got watercraft coming along. They're not going to see it until they're right on top of it.
That's right. The a typical farm with many devices, perhaps say 20 or 40, would have to be in an area which was forbidden to shipping. As you rightly say, you won't really see very much at all. They would have to have warning lights sticking up above the surface and so on. But, of course, one of the great advantages of it compared with wind turbines or any other type of device is it has almost no environmental impact at all.
Yeah, and also the visual impact for those people who don't like seeing wind turbines off the coast of their beautiful coastal beach homes. This type of system would basically be invisible to them.
Yes, that's right. When I say environmental impact, I include the visual impact as well.
Now, where are you in terms of prototyping?
Right. Well, we've got a proof of concept program running now for 1 year, which is going well, and this goes through a series of models scaling up until at the end of the year we will have a 1/10 scale model running. At the moment we're at about 1/25 scale in university wave tanks. We've also built a special tank ourselves which will generate precision bulge waves in a tube which we can connect to a power takeoff in order to test the power takeoff. All wave energy machines need a power takeoff, and often it's the power takeoff which proves to be one of the most difficult areas for the developers. So we do have this special device designed just to produce bulge waves so we can test different configurations of power takeoffs and valves and so on.
I didn't catch the name of the university you said is testing this.
It's we're collaborating with Southampton University, which has one of the leading engineering departments in the United Kingdom. And at Southampton University, Professor John Chaplin, he's the leader, together with Professor Grant Hearn, are undertaking a 3-year study for the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, which is a government-sponsored body, in order to really understand the interaction between the bulge tube and the water waves and to develop a comprehensive mathematical model of how it works.
Uh-huh. And this 1/4 scale, it seems like there's a video that you have showing this testing or the proof of concept, and the waves are maybe half a meter in the height.
Yes, it's 1/25 actually. Sorry, not 1/4. You could think it was. Yeah, it's 1/25 scale is what you've probably seen on the web. So the waves are actually quite small, perhaps about 10 centimeters, in fact. It's difficult to tell the scale.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard to see in that video, the tube moving up and down. You see the waves moving, but the tube doesn't seem to necessarily move in total synchrony. It's not wiggling 100% with the surface of the waves. It stays somewhat rigid.
That's right. The interaction between the tube itself and the passing waves is very complicated, and that's one of the reasons for this 3-year study and the mathematical modeling exercise. The amount that the tube stretches when it bulges is only about 15% of its circumference, so it's not actually very obvious to look at to see that there is a bulge being excited in the tube. Also the tube doesn't perfectly contour with the waves, and its movement really is quite complex. And as I said, this is one of the reasons for the study, so that we can understand the way in which it works fully, and so that we can design systems for optimum efficiency. But of course, this scientific study is only looking at the tube. We have to look at the whole system, which includes the power takeoff, so we can actually generate electricity. Suffice it to say that so far, the results we've got have been extremely encouraging. In fact, slightly better than we might have expected from the theory, which is very good.
Would an analogy also be of the, for example, the small intestine that has peristaltic movements that move the stuff along through there, and the peristaltic movements in this case would be like the ocean waves going along this tube that you have suspended in it?
Yes, that's right. It is like that. You can think of it in that way, except that in the gut, or indeed in the peristaltic pump, which are known as hose pumps. They use them in laboratories and on a larger scale in industry for moving fragile liquids. In laboratories, typically in heart-lung machines and things like that, where you can't have an impeller damaging platelets or whatever. You are actually squeezing the liquid along inside the tube. In our case, the liquid is only moving backs and forwards in the region of the bulge because the tube is not being completely constricted. It's the actual energy is being stored in the elasticity of the tube as the bulging part moves along.
I would think that one of the issues that you would have with this design would not be getting movement, because that would be fairly straightforward, but in getting enough head, enough pressure to actually turn a turbine to any useful extent.
Well, we envisage the use of a low head turbine. Such things are made for use in low height dams. At full scale, the pressure generated would be about one atmosphere, and the volume of water would be very considerable from a 7 meter diameter tube. Each sort of squirt of water from the end would be probably about 150 tons of water. So that begin to appreciate the amount of energy that's available. And then, of course, that water would be drawn back into the tube when the tube expands again.
What kind of liquid do you plan on running through the tube?
Oh, just ordinary seawater. Nothing special. You don't need anything special to preserve the rubber or anything like that.
Would you have to keep it from freezing?
Yes, you wouldn't want it to freeze, but certainly in the sort of sea conditions that we envisage, where the anaconda would be deployed, the freezing wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, maybe it's a bias from coming up, I'm making this connection between Tesla's patent and the work that you're doing.
It's not really that similar, to be perfectly honest. Tesla's machine relies on fluidics, and people have devised logic gates which use fluidics, using a similar sort of principle to Tesla's valve of a small flow controlling a much larger one without having any moving parts. And you can build simple digital computers using these fluidic logic gates. The thing about them, though, of course, is they have to be quite precisely made. And our machine, as well, remember, is a closed cycle system, whereas Tesla envisaged liquid passing through this thing from one end to the other. So, although there might be some use to for it as a valve system, which, as I said, we do need a good valve system, the actual applicability in a sort of pumping tube is probably very limited, because the thing has to expand and contract. And certainly in his patent, Tesla envisaged the use of hard, metallic machined parts.
I would think that you would go one way or the other, not both. You would either use the expand and contraction, like the peristaltic movement that you're presently using. You use the name anaconda as a metaphor for the snake that swallows its prey and through peristaltic movement gradually moves it down its digestive tract. That would be one way. The other way would be to use like this Tesla thing where you wouldn't need to have any expansion contraction. It would be purely the movement of the fluid would be directionalized as the tube moves up and down and the fluid wants to be moving around. It's going to be biased in one direction like a diode. And so the fluid is going to be shooting in one direction just with the motions up and down of the waves. And
well, yes, but as I already said, you haven't got any resonance then. Without resonance, wave machines aren't efficient. You have to have something which is going to resonate with the frequency of the sea waves. And all you're really describing, if you'll forgive me, is a situation like, for instance, if you have a garden, a hose pipe for watering the lawn, it's full of water, there's no water flowing, it's laying on the grass, you pick it up, and you just walk along with your arm underneath it, so it slides under your arm, and as you lift it up as you go along, the water's just pushed out at one end. That's absolutely fine, and people have tried to build devices along these lines. You could build a device, but it wouldn't have anything like the power output of an anaconda-type machine, because it would not be resonating, and it's this stretching of the walls and the resonance which really give anaconda its unique potential, and of course which the whole patent for the system relies upon.
When you talk about resonance, you usually think in terms of frequencies and optimal frequencies, and if you've got a certain size of tube and you've got waves that vary from very small to very huge, how are you going to establish a resonance in that kind of variability?
Yeah, well, all wave machines, if they're going to be any good, have to have some sort of width of frequency response. And with Anaconda, we're very lucky that it does actually have a sufficiently wide frequency response to give a good average power output in real sea conditions. One of the limitations of buoy-type machines is that you can make a buoy resonate very nicely with the waves, but you can only make it resonate by altering its size or its weight, both of which you can't do while the thing is actually operating. So various buoy energy devices people have tried to vary the natural frequency of the buoy by various sort of clever devices, but they haven't really been very successful, with the result that in real sea conditions, buoy-type devices don't actually capture very much energy. Now, Anaconda, and there's another machine which is a long attenuator called Pelamis, which is steel tubes which are articulated with hydraulic rams, both overcome this, particularly Anaconda does, by having a wide frequency response. And that's the great advantage of that type of the Anaconda system compared with all others.
That Pelamis would probably be the closest to your design.
In a way, yes. It's long and narrow, and of course, Anaconda is long and narrow, and it's what's called an attenuator, as opposed to a point absorber like a buoy system. Of course, Pelamis is well advanced. It's a very ingenious machine. Very clever people have developed it, Sorry about that.
Dog wants to get on the show there.
Excuse me a moment. It's a very ingenious machine, but it is limited because it's made out of hard materials. And also its capture width is not as great as with Anaconda because of its method of operation.
Now, talking about unique, my understanding is that your patent is one of those cases where you have basically a, what do you call it, new principle of operation?
Yes, that's right. Unlike all the other systems which are around, it's actually the concept of operation which is patented rather than some sort of ingenious aspect of it.
Right, so it's like the very core principle is introduced in the patent, whereas most patents are variations of existing ideas.
Yes, that's right. This is one of the unique features of Anaconda, is it is a completely novel idea, which Professor Rod Rainey actually thought of.
How long has this idea been in the process of hatching?
We've been working with the two professors now for just over a year, and we've probably got another 2 to 3 years to go before we can put a full-scale prototype in the ocean.
Okay. And the after this one-year test is done, which when is that going to be over, this one-year?
That's scheduled to finish at the end of this year, 2008.
Okay. And when that's done, what's the next step?
Well, the next stage is really to build a bigger machine, which will be put in the ocean, and which will actually demonstrate the production of electrical power.
So it'd be a full-scale prototype?
Well, not necessarily full-scale at that stage, but certainly, of significant scale, like, say, one-fifth or one-quarter scale, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you'll run that one for a year?
Yeah, we'd like to run that for a significant length of time in order to establish its performance characteristics and also start to get some reliability data and stuff like that, because reliability, of course, in a machine which is out in the ocean is all important. And Anaconda has some unique advantages here because it's made of flexible materials, so it doesn't have hard limits with stops that can be come up against if big waves come along and so on. Its survivability, which is all important, is theoretically much greater than other systems.
How well would it hold up in a hurricane?
Well, the answer's fine, providing you've anticipated it. There are a number of options. Typically, you would depressurize it, so it would, and you would just sink it to the ocean floor.
Okay.
We don't envisage deploying it in hurricane areas, I might add. I mean, but nevertheless, you can get very big seas, as you know. Clearly, one has to design control systems which are going to allow it to survive in extreme conditions.
On the other end of the spectrum, could you anticipate at some point one of the locations of these Anaconda devices being at the opening of the bay, for example, where you want to attenuate incoming waves, and you could actually
I suppose you could, if you wanted to. I mean, typical locations are on ocean facing, west facing seaboards, such as we have off the west coast of Scotland, the west coast of Ireland, the west coast of southern England, South Africa. Southwest Australia, to the north of the North American continent, so sort of Oregon, Canada, various, you know, the Pacific Islands and locations like that. But the ideal location for any wave energy machine like this is where the long ocean swells have been able to build up over thousands of miles through wind action. Because we're really interested in the big ocean swells, perhaps with 150 meters between crests.
Okay. And would you be locating these near the shore or out to sea a little bit?
How close they are to the shore doesn't matter, providing the water's deep enough for the waves not to have been shortened by the shallowness of the water. So typically 2 or 3 miles offshore, something like that.
So you're going to have some transmission situation going on?
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, you need as I envisaged in the UK, subsea transformer stations and connections. And there is already one facility like this in the UK, off the coast of the islands to the north of Scotland, and there's another one planned off the coast of Cornwall, which is southwest England.
Now, you have a kind of a plastic that these tubes are made out of. Is it going to be some kind of a special material that can withstand the sun and the salt water?
Well, it's all a question, with rubber, it's all a question of how you mix it and what chemicals you mix it with in order to give it the characteristics you want, and also to make sure that it can survive in the conditions which it's going to operate in. Typically, the elastic part of the tube would actually be made from natural rubber. You really can't beat the mechanical characteristics of natural rubber in an engineering application like this. And that's why a lot of it is still used in automobile tires and stuff like that. It has the most superb characteristics. But then you have to compound it, as they say, to mix it with other chemicals in order to make it resistant to ultraviolet, to make so that you can manufacture it conveniently, and all sorts of other things. But it's not new technology.
Mm-hmm. So what would you see being the primary mechanical weakness or point that's going to require the most maintenance?
Well, the tube itself should require no maintenance during its life. If it were to be damaged, then the whole thing would have to be taken into port, and the device would have to be replaced. The parts which need most attention from the engineering design point of view are, if you like, more traditional moving parts like the valves, the electrical turbine, and so on. But of course, one of the advantages of Anaconda is that compared with other systems, it has so few moving parts. And that of course will make for greater reliability.
When you say so few moving parts, you're not counting the undulating tube that's going up and down?
Well, not really. No, that's flexing. It doesn't involve hinges. It doesn't involve mating surfaces that have to come together. There are no gears or cogs. It really is a very simple system compared with, certainly compared with Pelamis.
Mm-hmm. So the only moving parts are going to be primarily in the moving parts from the mechanical point of view, as you're just describing, would be in the turbine and the generator end of things.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're going to need control systems as well to maintain pressure, to monitor it. Monitor its health and all the other things you will need. I'm not saying that it's got no moving parts at all. But certainly compared with other systems which involve hydraulic rams, hydraulic turbines, motors, high-pressure accumulators, hinges, bearings, very complex control systems, and so on. It is a very simple device by comparison.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you'll be able to get the price down to 12 cents per kilowatt hour?
Well, we think so, and maybe less than that. I mean, that's just one figure, and one of the aims of our work now this year is to really define the cost of electricity more precisely, and we actually hope it will be less than that.
Mm-hmm. That certainly would be the what makes renewables so that they can compete with some of these more traditional and polluting sources of energy.
That's our aim. We hope that we will be the developers of the world's first truly competitive renewable energy source.
It's
quite an ambition.
Now, I thought wind was already there. These large 4-megawatt turbines are down to about 4 cents per kilowatt hour.
Yes, I think wind is doing fine, but it has disadvantages, obviously, because of resistance to placing turbines in people's backyards, so to speak. And also, I think there's a lot, certainly in the UK, there's a lot of debate about how cost-effective wind really is. A lot of the costs are disguised by government subsidies and stuff like that, so it's very difficult to tell really how cost-effective wind generation is. But on the other hand, at the moment, in a country like the UK, which has a commitment to producing 15% of its energy from renewables, wind is all the government has until something else like Anaconda is developed and proven to be cost-effective.
When we talk about renewables from environmental sources, wind, solar, one of the primary drawbacks is that they're not constant. The sun, even, you know, it shows during the day but not at night, and even during the day you've got clouds. So it's not a necessarily reliable from a 24/7 point of view. Wind is the same situation, is even less predictable than the solar, because you've got to keep track of the weather patterns, and then you're not going to be that accurate as solar in predicting what kind of exposure you're going to have to the wind. Wave energy, how reliable and variable is it?
Wave energy, certainly in the the sort of places which we've envisaged, and the UK has one of the best wave climates in the world from the point of view of energy production. And that's why a lot of effort has been put into wave energy machines here in the UK. The UK has, a very good wave climate with strong waves, which tend to be fairly continuous. So the overall capacity factor, as they say, of wave machines, if they can be made efficient, like Anaconda could be, or has the potential to be, will actually be better than wind machines.
In its predictability?
Yes. Of course, wave is a secondary product of wind in the first place, but it's capturing the wind over a huge area of ocean. So therefore, variations in the wind affect waves less. So therefore, waves are less variable than wind power.
Right, it's an average of the wind exposure over a large surface area.
That's right, exactly, yes, correct.
Whereas a single wind turbine is going to be getting that one point at any given time, this would be like an average over a large section, not necessarily wide, but going out into the ocean, the source of that propagation. But from a, I'm just curious, I've never looked at or seen data from how much the wave size varies over time at a given point on, let's say, for example, 2 miles out as you're describing. On the smallest, what is it? On the biggest, what is it? And what is the average? And how much does it go up and down?
Well, the data's rather complicated to present, and I don't have the data in front of me. But a good way of looking at it is what the annual average power output of a machine like Anaconda might be compared with its maximum rated output. And as I said, with Anaconda, we're looking at a rated output, which is what you need to build the machine for, so and the transmission lines so the wires don't melt and all that sort of thing, of, say, 1 megawatt, but an annual average output of, say, 600. 600 kilowatts. So about, you're talking about with a machine like Anaconda, it'd be able to make use of about 60% of the wave energy that's available throughout the year. If you're talking about the actual power in the waves, up off northwest Scotland, we're talking about an annual average power in the waves of about 55 kilowatts per meter of wave front, which is a high figure. Compared with other places in the world.
Okay. Could you
say the resource
that
we have a lot of
slower?
In the UK as wave energy, more so than other countries, and particularly in proportion to the size of our country as well.
The 65 kilowatts per what?
Per meter of wave front. So on average, the figures do vary slightly depending on who's collected the statistics, I must warn you. But on average, you're talking about 55 kilowatts for every meter length of the wave as you look at it coming towards you. Mm-hmm. So 2 meters, 110 kilowatts, 100 meters, 5,500 kilowatts, and so on. So there's a lot of energy there.
Yeah, and so the efficiency of most wave energy devices is in what range? 10%, 40%?
Somewhat, normally less. I can't claim to be an expert on other people's machines, but suffice it to say that they tend, although they might talk about a maximum power output, which can seem impressive, most developers tend not to like to talk about the annual average power, because the annual average power really does reflect this ability to gather energy from a wide variety of sea states. I think normally this annual average power, which is related to the capacity factor of the machine, is probably, I'm guessing, say 20 or 30%, rather like a wind turbine.
Okay. So just doing some quick math here, when you talk about a megawatt output, and you're taking into consideration the 65 kilowatt per meter squared wavefront, if you had 100% efficiency, you would need 15 square meters to produce 1 megawatt.
Yeah, it's per linear meter of the wavefront. Sorry, I think you misheard me. Per linear meter. So 10 linear meters of the wave will give you 550 kilowatts.
I'm not catching that word. You're saying millimeter.
Linear. The width across the width of the wave, not the area of the wave, the width of the wave.
Okay.
Fifty-five kilowatts per meter is about the average wave strength off the southwest of Scotland, in the UK here.
And I'm doing this for the sake of my audience, because there may be some people who are not as familiar with this as you are, like myself. I'm trying to picture this. When you say 65 kilowatts per meter, I'm wanting to think a square meter, like you think of in solar.
No, I mean per linear meter. If you look at a wave, imagine a wave coming towards you,
mm-hmm.
The wave has a, you can see the crest of the wave coming towards you, and obviously the wave has some width as you look at it, doesn't it? And I'm talking about per meter of width as you look at it from the front as it comes towards you.
Mm-hmm. So 1 meter wide?
Yes, so for every meter of, yes, that's right. So for every meter of width, there's about 55 kilowatts of energy on average.
I see. So if you had a plane 1 meter wide, and you're measuring the wave power going up and down across that plane 1 meter wide, it's 65 kilowatts.
Yes, so I think you missed that being 55, not 65, but
oh,
yes,
55.
You're right.
Okay. All right, I think I understand now what that, and it's called linear meter?
Linear meters, yes, that's right, yeah.
Can
as opposed to square
I'm
meters.
Your accent's not coming across for me.
Sorry. I've also got a heavy cold. Typical British summer weather, I'm afraid.
So could you spell the word in front of meter?
Yep, linear. L-I-N-E-A-R.
Okay. That's what I thought you said.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's talk for a second about some of the considerations of what one of these wind farms or wave farms would look like. If you had a 1 megawatt unit, would it be one giant tube that's producing 1 megawatt, or would it be 10 smaller tubes in a farm producing 1 megawatt?
Typically, each tube would be big, as I said, maybe 200 meters long, 7 meters in diameter. And that would produce a maximum output of 1 megawatt. So a farm might have, say, 20 or 40 or more actual devices installed. So it would cover quite a large area.
Okay. And would you have to have these situated so that one would not bump into the other one?
Yes, they have to have space so they can swing. And so they can remain head to sea. of course, in the sort of places we're talking about, generally speaking, the waves only really, the big waves, which is the ones we're interested in, only really come from one direction, from the west.
And how much pull will it have? When you're fastening it to the ocean floor so it doesn't go drifting off, how much force are you going to have to resist for a unit that big?
Not very much, because all that the ocean is doing is moving it up and down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not pulling against it at all. They would not be situated in areas where there are particularly significant currents or tides. We're talking about offshore areas where, in the open ocean, there might be some current, admittedly, due to things like the Gulf Stream, but the overall sort of tugging effect on the thing would be really comparatively small.
Okay. So from a fastening or mooring point of view, do you have one generator turbine per tube, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yes, with a connection typically going down the mooring line to an undersea substation where the power would be conditioned and made suitable for connection to the national electricity grid.
Okay. And how are you going to are you going to have the generator turbine apparatus on a buoy?
This would be at the incorporated in the machine at the stern end, it would be part of the structure. It would be probably the only part of the structure which would require to be a hard structure. We've made, in other words, metallic. The rest of it we envisage making from either elastic materials for the tube itself, where the energy is captured, or for the accumulators and other parts that are necessary for the power takeoff from fabrics under tension. Similar to those used for hovercraft skirts, which we have a lot of expertise in.
With the generator and turbine in there, that's going to be pretty heavy. How are you going to keep that from sinking?
Oh, it'll need buoyancy control, obviously, and that's one of the control systems which the device will require, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Rubber itself, which is the main part of the tube, is about the same density as seawater. So the thing will just about be buoyant. It may need a little bit of help, but the main part of the machine itself will naturally just float, which is what we want.
You talked earlier in the case of a hurricane of sinking it down. How would you do that?
Well, the machine has to be pre-pressurized anyway. If it's not, it wouldn't work properly. And the pressurization affects the tuning of the machine to the wavelength of ocean waves that you want to get the energy from. Typically, you would depressurize it, and as I said, it would require some buoyancy system, so you could actually let it descend 20 or 30 meters so that it's out of harm's way.
Now, if I understand right, even that far down, you're still getting some, pressure or undulation of sorts from
yes.
the waves passing overhead.
That's right. The machine would, to be frank, this is an aspect of the design which we haven't gone into detail yet on. But the machine might even be able to stay on the surface, and with suitable protection with blow-off valves and so on to vent excess power, it could even keep running in extreme conditions.
So even in a hurricane, as you drop it down 20 meters, for example, it could still be generating power?
It could be, yes.
Mm-hmm. Would you anticipate that you actually would still be generating power?
If you could do it safely, then why not?
Uh-huh.
The great advantage of the machine in that it has no hard limits. In other words, as I said before, there are no metallic stops to, you know, hinges to bend, things which can be damaged. If the machine suddenly absorbs more energy than it was originally designed for, it'll be stretched a bit more, but because of the nature of rubber, that's not going to be the end of the machine at all. It'll just continue on as normal when the wave conditions moderate.
Now, this we've been talking about anaconda here, and this is actually one of several technologies. Checkmate C Energy has, what, four technologies, and you're part of the larger group called the Checkmate Group. Maybe we can talk about that for a minute.
That's before. Right, yeah. We're a medium-sized British company. Checkmate C Energy is part of the Checkmate Group. The other three parts of the company, well, the most relevant one is called Avon Fabrications. Avon Fabrications is a specialist engineering company that makes things from sheet rubber, and that was why the inventors came to us, because of our knowledge and expertise in the fabrication of sheet rubber. And the thing which we make, which is most similar to Anaconda, is large parts for hovercraft. The other two parts of the company are concerned with ships lifting gear, in particular polyester lifting slings, and the third bit is to do with height safety equipment, forward rest harnesses, fixed lifelines for buildings, and so on.
And that's the Checkmate Group in general, or
Checkmate? That's the Checkmate Group in general. Yep. Uh-huh. We're a major exporter. Over 60% of what we make in the group actually goes outside the European Union, and we've won a few years ago. We won a government award called the Queen's Award for industry for our achievements in export, and just this year, Avon Fabrications won an innovation award for development of a new type of cargo protection system for ships' cargoes using a special type of airbag.
Now, I noticed there are a couple of websites about the Anaconda. One is bulgewave.com. The other is piggybacked off of checkmateuk.com/
Yes, that's right.
Energy.
Bulgewave.com is the original website set up by one of the inventors, Professor Francis Farley.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still running. The object of that is to publicize the sort of technical aspects of it. The other one is, as you just said, part of the Checkmate Group website, and that's where we plan to talk more about the development of the system, and as we get better and better information, its commercial aspect.
Yeah. If a person wants to invest in this technology, what do they do?
Well, the best thing to do would be to use the inquiry form, which is on the Checkmate website, in order to contact us, and we will. We've had a number of inquiries already, as you can imagine. At the moment, we're funding the development ourselves, but the time will come when we do seek external funding, then we will review those who've actually expressed an interest.
We're just about wrapping up here. Is there anything that we've not covered yet that you would like to cover?
I don't think so. It's been a very interesting talk, and I've much appreciated the opportunity to talk about Anaconda. Please keep looking at our website to keep updated. Obviously, we're very excited about it because of its unique and totally novel operating concept, and we hope that we will be the people who will develop the world's first really significant alternative to wind energy.
All right, well, we appreciate you coming on this show. Again, for our guests, we've been talking to Tom Roach. He is with the Checkmate C Energy Group that has licensed this Anaconda technology. And you can visit their website at checkmateuk.com/cenergy/system.html. That's a link from our coverage at pezwiki.com. Just Google Anaconda there and you'll find them. Thanks again, Tom, for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.